Please turn in your Bibles to the book of Esther, chapter 8. Esther, chapter 8, I'll begin the reading at the last verse in chapter 7. Esther, chapter 7, verse 10. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. And the king extended the golden scepter to Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. Then she said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which shall fall upon my people, and how shall I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows, which he had stretched out, because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for a decree which is written in the name of the king, and sealed with the king's signet ring, may not be revoked." So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, and sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horses, riding on steeds sired by the king's royal stud. In them the king granted the Jews, who were in each and every city, the right to assemble, and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, which that is the month of Adar, a copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the peoples, so that the Jews should be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Couriers hastened and, impelled by the king's command, went out, riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out in Susa, the capital. Then Mordecai went on from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor, and in each and every province, and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. The events of this book of Esther took place about 485 B.C., in the ancient Persian Empire, about 100 years before the Jewish people had been taken captive from their native land of Israel by King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian army, into the captivity of Babylon. About 50 years before these events, the kingdom of Babylon had become the Persian Empire, and that's where these events took place here in the book of Esther. Before their captivity, when the Jewish people were still in their own land of Israel, they often looked and trusted, whether right or wrong, to the external blessings that God had given them in that land and the things that they could see. They trusted that His favor was upon them because they were in the land of His promise, which He had swore to their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They trusted in the city of Jerusalem, their great capital, the city of God, and the place where He had chosen for His worship. And they trusted in the great temple of Solomon, the most magnificent structure that the world had ever seen, and the temple worship that was there. All of these external blessings, they were the symbols, they were the evidences to them of God's favor and His presence with them as His people. But now in the captivity, in this book of Esther, all of those external blessings, all of those symbols that they could see, they were all gone. The city of Jerusalem had been burned to the ground, the great temple of Solomon destroyed, and they were far removed from God's land of promise, more than 1,000 miles away. The symbols of God's favor, the evidences, the tokens of who they were as His people, they were all gone, and they could no longer look to them, and they could no longer trust in them as they once did. And it was also because of His judgment upon them, because of their own sin, that all of these things had taken place. And now in the land of captivity, the great trial of their faith was, could they still trust in the invisible God? And would He still be to them the God of the promises and remember them as His people, the God who would never leave or forsake them? And the answer of the book of Esther is over and over, the answer to that question is yes. He had proven to them in every way that He was still their God, and He would guide them, protect them, and defend them wherever they were, even in that distant and pagan land of Persia. He is still the God of sovereignty who rules over all the affairs of the nations. And He is able to help His people by His good and powerful providences. This is what we learn in the book of Esther, and this is what we've seen to be true so far. And the same thing is still true for us today in the land in which we live, a very distant land to the ends of the earth, in a land that is becoming increasingly anti-God and secular, in a land in which we see the powers of sin increasing and prevailing. And we wonder what the future will hold for us. Will the God of Esther's day still prove Himself to be faithful to us? Will He still come to us and help us, protect us, and deliver us in our times of need, in our times of trouble? And the answer is still yes, because He is the immutable and unchanging God. And the God of Esther's day is still the God of our day. And we may trust Him, and we may look to Him for help and grace in every time of need and trouble. It is a marvelous pillow to rest your head on at night, the pillow of God's good and gracious providence. What a sweet pillow, what a safe pillow to rest our heads upon each night. As we come here to chapter 8 in this book of Esther, many of the difficulties which faced God's people had already been overcome. Esther had gained an entrance before the king, and she now had favor in the eyes of Ahasuerus, and by her shrewd and careful, skillful words and planning of her banquets, She had cornered wicked Haman before the king. And by the king's command, Haman had been taken out and put to death. And as chapter 7 closes, the wicked man Haman has been hung on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. And things seem to be going very well for the Jews. But despite all of these marvelous providences of God and the favorable turn of events for them, the great crisis still was before them. And it had not yet passed. It was still there because the edict which Haman had issued for the destruction of the Jews throughout the entire kingdom, that edict was still in force, and nothing had changed in regard to it. And the preparation of the enemies of the Jews throughout the kingdom was taking place for that certain day in the 12th month when the annihilation of all the Jews would take place. The edict had been sealed by the king's signet ring, which meant it could not be altered or reversed. And if that was true, and if all of Haman's edict still was in force and nothing could be done, then all of Esther's efforts up to this point would be for nothing and be in vain. All of God's wonderful providences and all that she had accomplished, what good would it do if that edict could not be changed? There was still much that had to be done, and much that still hung in the balance. The one who made the plot had been hung upon the gallows, but his plot still had to be undone. In the previous chapters, we have seen Haman and Mordecai as arch enemies of one another. The evil and wicked man, Haman, and Mordecai, the good and the righteous man, in God's providences, a number of reversals between Haman and Mordecai had already taken place. Back in chapter 6, Haman had arranged that magnificent royal parade through the city streets, in which one would wear the king's robes and ride on his royal horse with the crown upon his head, and everything had been reversed, and Haman's parade became Mordecai's parade, and it was Mordecai who rode through the city streets in that royal honor. In chapter 7, the gallows which Haman had built for the execution of Mordecai, they became the gallows that Haman himself were hung upon. And as chapter 8 begins, now we have two other reversals that take place between Haman and Mordecai. The first is a reversal of wealth and property. Verse 1 begins in chapter 8. On that day, meaning on that very same day which began back in the beginning of chapter 6, when the king could not sleep and he called for the book of the records to be read for him. And then all the providences of God that began to take place and unfold themselves throughout that day. Mordecai's parade through the city, Esther's second banquet, and Haman being hung upon the gallows. It was still that day. What an amazing day it was, and how much God can accomplish in a single day. That day now continues here in verse 1 of chapter 8. On that same day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. With the death of Haman, all the property that had belonged to Haman became the possession of King Ahasuerus. And on that same day, he gave it all to Queen Esther, and then Queen Esther gave it all to Mordecai, as we read at the end of verse 2. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Haman was the second most powerful man in all the kingdom. And it must have been a very large estate that belonged to him, of land, property, buildings, money, servants. Back in chapter 1, we read of the great wealth of the Persian Empire. In the king's garden, there were couches of gold and silver. There were all of the golden vessels for drinking the wine. There was great wealth in that Persian Empire, and much of that wealth must have belonged to Haman. In chapter 5, Haman boasted of the glory of his riches and all that belonged to him. But now it belonged all to Mordecai. A most astonishing reversal had taken place. Mordecai was only a poor servant serving at the king's gate, and Haman was a man of great wealth and property. But now everything that had once belonged to Haman belonged to Mordecai. A great reversal of wealth, land, and property. A second great reversal that we see here is a reversal of power and authority. We see at the end of verse 1. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed who he was to her. Now Mordecai had never been in the presence of the king before. The king had only known him, it seems, by name from the reading of the books of the Chronicles the night before. They had never seen one another face to face, and they had never been in the presence of one another. And what seems to have happened here is that at the end, the conclusion of the second banquet, as Haman was taken out to be hung, Queen Esther and King Ahasuerus were left alone. And Esther decided the time had finally come to tell the king who Mordecai was to her as her cousin. We can imagine Queen Esther saying something of this, like this, to the king: "O king, if I have found favor in your sight, and if it is pleasing in the sight of the king, let me inform you of something. Do you remember that man Mordecai? That man that you first heard of last night when they read the Chronicles to you? The man who had saved your life some years before from the assassination attempt? That same man that you honored this morning, this very morning, in that grand royal parade through the city streets? That man Mordecai, he is my cousin. He is my closest of kindred. And he is the very man who took me when I was an orphan as a little girl and raised me through all those years." What a surprise it must have been for the king to hear that Mordecai, who he really was, he was the cousin, the closest kindred to the queen. So the king sent for Mordecai to be brought in quickly from the king's gate into the palace. And now Mordecai appears in the presence of the king, and he stands before the king, and we read of what happens in verse 2. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. So when Haman was sent out, you remember back in chapter 3, the king had given his signet ring to Haman, and it was the symbol of the power that belonged to him, that he could do whatever he pleased. Haman had been sent out now to be executed on the gallows, but the king had taken back the signet ring. Haman is now gone, and he is never again to be seen. And now what the king does is he takes his signet ring and he gives it to Mordecai to show that all the power that once belonged to Haman now belongs to him. Another great reversal has taken place. Two reversals here: a reversal of land and wealth, and a second reversal of power and authority, so that whatever once belonged to Haman now belongs to righteous Mordecai. And in these events, God shows us what he will do in the end of time in the world to come. He will not just destroy evil, as we saw in Haman upon the gallows. But he will take all of the wealth, all of the land, the power and authority that belongs to the wicked in this world, and he will give it to his saints in the new heavens and in the new earth. We speak of the physical land of this world, but a renewed world in the new heavens and new earth. We speak of the physical land, but we also speak of the spiritual and figurative terms of all that will be ours in the world to come. And we have many such promises of these things in the scriptures. We have promises of land and wealth. Psalm 37 and verse 11. But the humble, the believer, but the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. Isaiah spoke of this, Isaiah 60 and chapter 61 as well. The wealth of the nations, he said, will come to you, and their riches, and in their riches you will boast. John tells us about the ultimate fulfillment of these things in Revelation chapter 21, in the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and her brilliance was like a very costly stone. And the foundation stones of the city were adorned with every kind of precious stone, and the city was of pure gold, like glass, clear glass, and the street of the city was pure gold and transparent glass. So all of the land, all of the wealth of the things of this world will belong to the saints in the end. And then we have promises of power and authority as kings, given to us in the world to come as well. Jesus has made us to be kings, a kingdom of kings and priests who will sit upon his throne with him. Paul said to the Corinthians in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians, he said, "Do you not know? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? Do you not know that you shall judge angels?" Jesus said to his disciples in the Gospels, "When the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, then you shall sit on the 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Revelation chapter 2 and verse 26, he said, "He who overcomes and he who keeps my deeds until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as vessels of the potter are broken into pieces. As I also have received authority from my Father, I will give him the morning star." So in whatever form these things will take place, just as with Haman and Mordecai, this great reversal of things had taken place. All of the land, the wealth of Haman, the power, the authority of Haman, it was all taken and given to Mordecai. So it shall be for all of his saints in the world to come. The wealth, the land that the wicked have taken for themselves, the glory, the power, the authority that they hold in this world, it will all be taken from them, and it will be given to Christ. And through Christ, it will be given to us who belong to him, and we shall have all things in this present world. We speak of a world to come that will not be a world like this present world of sin and evil, but we speak of a world that will be sinless, it will be holy, and it will be pure. The Apostle Paul put it this way in 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 21. He said, "For all things belong to you." Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, or the world, or life or death, or things present or things to come, all things belong to you. And you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. So in this great reversal that we see here of wealth, land, power, authority, transferred from the wicked to the righteous Mordecai, we have a picture of all these things being given to God's saints in the end. We read in verse 3. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. So here we have Esther and Mordecai in the presence of the king. And Esther makes this most earnest and importunate plea with the king. On every previous occasion, Esther had always maintained her composure. She had always kept up her royal dignity as the queen, but now she is so distraught and overcome with emotion, she falls down before the king and she begins to implore him and plead with him to do whatever was possible to avert Haman's plot against the Jews. In the previous chapter, Haman fell at Esther's feet and pleaded only for his own life, and his plea was unsuccessful. Now Esther falls at the feet of the king and pleads not for her own life, but for the life of her people, and her plea will be successful. We read in verse 4 and 5, and the king extended the golden scepter to Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. Then she said, if it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. So in verse 4, the king once again extends the golden scepter to her, showing his favor and approval to her. But then in verse 5, Esther shows her continued shrewdness and skill in speech as she piles up these deferential clauses before the king. She uses 4 of them here in the beginning of verse 5. The first and the third speak of the king. The first clause was, if it pleases the king. And then the third was, and the matter seems proper to the king. And then the second and the fourth clause speak of her finding favor before the king. The second clause was, and if I have found favor before him. And the fourth was, if I am pleasing in his sight. So what we have here is one respectful statement after another, to show more deference, submission to the king, to gain more of his favor in his presence. Esther gives us an example of how we should deal with those in authority over us, and especially when we desire something which they have the power to give. And if all 4 of these are true, then she makes her request that Haman's edict be reversed in the middle of verse 5. She says, let it be written to revoke the letters that have been devised by Haman, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. We notice that Esther does not speak of the king when she speaks of this decree. She speaks of Haman only, who wrote the decree. But the king had his role in that decree because it was sealed with his signet ring, and so he had a part in it, but Esther skillfully avoids any mention of the king. In verse 6 now, she makes this very emotional plea that she could not ever bear to see such a thing happen to her own people. For how can I endure, she says, to see the calamity that will befall my people? And how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? What she is saying to the king is, if I have found any favor, if I have found any sympathy in your sight, then how can you allow me to endure to see the destruction and the death of my own people and my kindred? How could you allow me to pass through such distress and such anguish as this? The The problem was, the king could not reverse Haman's edict. He could not grant her request as she had asked him, because she had asked him for it to be revoked, for it to be nullified, for it to be canceled. But according to the law of the Persians, no edict of the king, no decree of the king could ever be reversed. It had been sealed with his signet ring, and his hands were tied, and in his mind there was nothing that he could do. How could he reverse the irreversible and do what was not possible? And so the king responds now in verse 7. So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, and to Mordecai the Jew, to both of them he said, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews." The king knew he could not grant Esther's request and cancel the previous edicts. So what he does here is he only reminds Esther of what he has already done for her. He has already put Haman to death on the gallows, and he has already taken all that belonged to Haman and given it to them, as if he is saying to them, "Look at what I have already done for you already. Is that not enough? And can you expect me to even do more than what I have already done?" We notice at the end of verse 7 that Ahasuerus claimed that he had hung Haman on the gallows at the end of verse 7 because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews. That was not the full and honest truth, because the real reason why at the end of chapter 7 was he had found Haman falling down at the couch where Esther was seated. And he said, "Well, he even assault the queen with me in the house." And then he commanded Haman to be hung on the gallows. So Ahasuerus is making it appear that he has done more for Esther than he actually had. We read in verse 8, he says to them, now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. The king here admitted that he did not know what to do. He was in what we would call a conundrum, a dilemma, a very difficult problem which seemed to have no answer. How could he reverse the irreversible, revoke what could not be revoked? And so what he does here is he gives free rein to Esther and Mordecai to write whatever decree they wish. The beginning of the verse, he says, "Now you write to the Jews as you see fit. You write whatever you please, whatever you want. If you can find a way out of this conundrum, if you can find a way to reverse the irreversible, then you write the decree in whatever way you want, and I will back it with my authority as the king. You may write it in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring." And then he states what will be true of this new decree, just as with Haman's first decree, a decree that is written in the name of the king and sealed with the signet ring. It may not be revoked. Haman's previous decree of death still remained in force. But Esther and Mordecai could now devise their own decree, which would be of equal force. And it had to be a decree that counteracted and counterbalanced Haman's first decree. They wasted no time to do so, we read in verses 9 and 10. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to carry every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent the letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. The decree which Mordecai came up with, it had to be a decree which in effect nullified, overturned the decree of Haman and his death and the death of the Jews. And we read of the content of Mordecai's decree in the following verses. Several things we note. The first is that it was only a defensive decree. In the beginning of verse 11, we read, "In them, in these letters of decree, the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend themselves." The only thing this new decree gave to the Jews was the right for them to assemble themselves together in each city and to defend their own lives, but only against those who were attacking them. To assemble to defend their own lives, a decree of self-defense. It was the very opposite of Haman's decree, which was an offensive, aggressive decree to go out and find every Jew and to kill them, to annihilate them for nothing that they had done. Mordecai's decree gave them no authority to go on the offense, but only to defend their lives. The second thing Mordecai's decree did was it was parallel with Haman's decree in the rest of verse 11. We read, "It was made to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil." The words here were the exact words of Haman's decree back in chapter 3. Some have had trouble over this, because it includes children and women. But it was exactly the same words that Haman had used in his decree. When it speaks of plundering the spoil, it was what Haman's decree had said as well. Mordecai was only copying Haman's original decree. But in this decree, in Mordecai's decree, no enemy of the Jews, no enemy of the Jews or anyone in their families would be killed unless they first attacked the life of the Jews. Whoever was peaceful toward the Jews, they would be peaceful in return. They were peacemakers, seeking only the defense of their own lives. The third thing is that Haman's decree was restricted to only one day, as Mordecai's decree was restricted to only one day, as Haman's had been as well. We read in verse 12, "On one day, only one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month Adar." The day that's mentioned here, the 12th day of the 13th day of the 12th month, that was the same day that Haman's decree had set for the destruction of the Jews. And at this point, that day was still about 9 months away. Back in chapter 3, when Haman made his decree, you remember that he cast lots to find what day it would be. And in the marvelous providence of God, who rules over all things, even the lots were cast, and the day that was chosen was this 13th day of the 12th month. And it was still 11 months away at that time, and now it is 9 months away, which gives plenty of time for this new decree of Mordecai to be issued, and plenty of time for the Jews to prepare their own defense. Back in chapter 3, verse 13, when we read of Haman's decree, we read that it was published to all the peoples so that they might be ready for that day. So Haman's decree went out, and they were told in all the provinces to prepare themselves and to get themselves ready, all the enemies of the Jews, so that when that day came, They could kill, annihilate, and destroy all the Jews. But now, Mordecai's decree is sent out. And we see at the end of verse 13 that it says, so that the Jews should be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemy. The enemies of the Jews would be ready when that day of annihilation finally came. But now we have a new decree so that the Jews themselves will be ready when that day comes for their own defense. The king sent Mordecai's decree out with his authority, and approved by him, it was carried by the king's couriers on horses swiftly riding throughout all the provinces of the kingdom, from India in the east to Ethiopia in the west. And so now there were two decrees. There were two decrees that had been issued throughout the entire kingdom of Persia. One decree, Haman's decree, a decree of death upon the Jews, and Mordecai's decree, a decree for their defense on that day. Both of these decrees sealed with the king's signet ring, both of them irreversible, both of them of equal force and power, each of them opposed to one another, Haman's decree and Mordecai's decree. And now what takes place is we must wait for 9 months to see which decree will win and what will come on that day, the 13th day of the 12th month. But whoever knew the events of this day and everything that had happened on this day and all of God's providences that had taken place, anyone who knew what had happened on this day would also know and see clearly what was to come on that day of these decrees. It was clear now that everything was turning in favor of the Jews, and all their enemies were on the run. The new decree was sent out now in the capital city of Susa. We read in verse 15 and 16, then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. When they saw Mordecai coming out of the king's palace, dressed in these royal robes of blue and white and the large crown of gold upon his head, they knew what it meant. They knew what it meant that he had taken the place of Haman as the right-hand man of the king. That wicked, proud, and evil Haman, he was gone. And there was no mourning for him. And Mordecai had taken his place, and Mordecai had issued his new decree. And there was joy, there was gladness, and there was celebration, not just for the Jews in that city of Susa, but for all the people. The whole city rejoiced and shouted for joy. And then we read in verse 16, for there was light and gladness and joy and honor. Back in chapter 4, when Haman first issued his decree of death upon the Jews, Mordecai was in sorrow, and he was clothed at the king's gate in sackcloth. Esther was inside the palace. When she heard of Mordecai outside at the gate in sackcloth, she sent new garments out to be put on him. But Mordecai would not wear them, because they were not fitting for his sorrow. But now his sorrow is gone, and he is clothed in these royal robes. He would not accept Esther's new garments because at that time there had been no deliverance of the Jews. But now the deliverance is before them. It has come, and Mordecai's clothing must reflect his joy. And so he goes out of the king's presence, covered, wearing these royal robes of blue and white and the crown of gold upon his head. Earlier in the day, Mordecai had put on royal robes and the king's crown, and he had gone out into the city on that royal parade. But that was only for a moment. After his parade, he went back to the king's gate to serve where he had been before. And we can imagine that when he went back to the king's gate, he put back on his sackcloth, which he had been wearing before, because at that time there was still no way of deliverance for the Jews. But now this most amazing transformation has taken place in this chapter for Mordecai. The chapter begins with Mordecai still serving at the gate, wearing his sackcloth. Then he is invited into the king's presence, and the king gives him, through Esther, all of the property and wealth of Haman, takes the signet ring of Haman, gives it to Mordecai, and then Mordecai takes off his sackcloth and puts on these royal robes of blue and white and the crown of gold upon his head. A most astonishing reversal of things for Mordecai, and he is now the second most powerful man in the kingdom. And the Jews have a way of deliverance from their enemies. The city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. Back in chapter 3, when Haman's decree had first been issued of death upon the Jews, you remember it said that the city of Susa was in confusion. The Jews were weeping. And now the whole city rejoices and shouts for joy, and the Jews are filled with gladness and honor. When we read in the beginning of verse 16, it says, for the Jews there was light. A rather unique expression here. It implies that there was darkness before, but now the light has come. There was the darkness of terror, confusion. There was the darkness of perplexity and not knowing what to do and what the future would hold. But now there is light, and their fears have been removed, and they can see what lies before them and what they must do. A great reversal, a change has taken place. The darkness of the previous days have now suddenly been turned into light. And all of this was by God's amazing and powerful providences to them. It was a work that only He could do. This is what He is able to do for all of His saints. And this is what He will do in the end as well. Psalm 30 and verse 5, His anger is but for a moment, and His favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may last for the night, but a shout of joy comes in the morning. Verse 11, Thou hast turned for me my mourning into dancing. Thou hast loosened my sackcloth and girded me with gladness. That's what happened with Mordecai and Esther and all the Jews and even all the people of that city on that day. And not just the city, but the whole kingdom. We read in verse 17, and in each and every province, and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. When the people throughout the entire kingdom heard of what had happened, the terrible fall of Haman, Haman now hanging on the gallows, the second most powerful man in the kingdom, dead on his own gallows, and the rise of Mordecai, and Mordecai now exalted to that same position, and Mordecai has the signet ring of the king, and he has issued his new decree. When all of this was known among the peoples throughout the kingdom, they rejoiced and they were glad, but they also dreaded the Jews, because in all of God's works he had shown that they were his people. His favor and his love were upon them, and the people of the provinces trembled before them. We're reminded of what happened when the people of Israel were brought through the Red Sea in that great deliverance. And the Song of Moses, chapter 15 of the book of Exodus, says this, that the people heard of all that had been done, and they trembled. Terror and dread fell upon them. By the greatness of thine arm, they are motionless as stone. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 25, God said, this day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the peoples everywhere under the heavens, who when they hear of the report of you shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. And then in Deuteronomy 11 and verse 25, when they were about to go into the promised land, God said this, no man shall be able to stand before you. The Lord your God shall lay the dread of you and the fear of you on all the land which you shall set foot, as he has spoken to you. That's what the Lord is able to do. To take a people here, the Jews in the book of Esther, who when this story began were filled with fear themselves, now he turns everything so that the peoples themselves throughout all the provinces are in dread of these people, the Jews, because the favor and power of God is upon them. You remember Haman's wife, Zeresh. After that first banquet, Haman went home and told Zeresh what had happened to him, and how he had to lead Mordecai through the parade earlier that day. And Haman's wife, Zeresh, said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. That was the beginning of this dread of the Jews. It came upon Haman's wife first. If that man Mordecai is of the God of Israel, then you will fall before him. And then the dread spread to Haman when he sat at that second banquet and he was terrified. And now the dread of the Jews has spread to all the people throughout all the provinces. And that's what God did. And that's what he can do in his powerful ways with men. The God who rules all the nations and the hearts of all people can bring about such a change for his own people. We close our time this morning. We consider once again the great differences between King Ahasuerus and our King in heaven, the true and living God. Just like there was a decree of death here in this book of Esther, so there is a decree of death upon us as well. For our sins, all of us are under this decree. It is irreversible in that sense. God has said the soul that sins must die, and the wages of sin is death. The King of Heaven has a decree of death upon men for their sins. But when our God saw us under the danger of that decree, he did not say, as King Ahasuerus said in verse 7, look at all that I have already done for you. Is it not enough? And there is nothing more that I can do. He did not say that. He said, I must now do whatever must take place for the salvation of my people, and I will give whatever and whomever I must give to save them from that decree? When our God was faced with that great conundrum, that dilemma of how can sinners be made right with a holy God in heaven? And how can they be cleansed of all of their sins and be made righteous before me? He did not say, as King Ahasuerus said in verse 8, I do not know what to do, and I do not really even care what to do. No, our God said, I will find a way to save sinners. And I will do the most wonderful, astonishing thing for their salvation. I will send my beloved Son, Jesus, into the world. I will send him to the death of the cross to take the penalty of sin, so that now I can forgive sinners, I can cleanse them, and wash them of all their sins. This is what he said. He said, I will find a way. I will give whomever I must give to save sinners. And that's what the great God in heaven has done. He has sent his beloved Son to the death of the cross, and in him we can find forgiveness and peace with God and eternal life. And all are invited to come to the beloved Son of God and find mercy and salvation and deliverance from him. Let's pray together. Father and God in heaven, we do bless you for your marvelous ways, for all of your amazing providences. You are the great and mighty God who guides all the affairs of this world. And we are your people, and we do believe in your beloved Son, Jesus. And we do cling to him by faith, that he is our only hope, our only strength, our only way of salvation. We do thank you and bless you for him. And we do pray that you would bless your word to us and encourage us with it and give us grace and strength that we need in all things to be pleasing in your sight. Thank you, great God of heaven, for the way of grace and mercy and salvation that you have given to us in your beloved Son. Bless now this day to us and be with us as your people. Make it a day of joy and gladness to us, and we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.